I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The New Statesman.
In March, Charles Spencer, the 9th Earl Spencer, published his memoir, A Very Private School. This recounted, in devastating detail, the abuse, both mental and physical, that he had been subjected to at his elite prep boarding school. The brutality is laid bare. For listeners not so familiar with the private school system, a prep school in the UK is for children aged 7 or 8 through to 13 years old. For centuries in the UK, a private education has been the pathway to opportunity. Today, those who attended private schools are 5 times more likely to hold top jobs in politics, the judiciary, media, and business. Boarding school boys in particular, who represent less than 1% of the population, have been in charge of the country for most of the past 14 years. But at what cost? For both the survivors of these institutions and for the whole country. I'm Hannah Barnes, and you're listening to the New Statesman podcast. To speak about all this and more, I was joined by the writer and poet laureate between 1999 and 2009, Andrew Motion, and the author, Richard Beard. Both Andrew and Richard have written for the New Statesman on boarding schools and Britain's relationship with these institutions. And you can find the links to their pieces in the show notes. Similar to Charles Spencer, both Andrew Motion and Richard Beard were sent to boarding school by their parents when they were just 7 or 8 years old. Andrew's experience in particular was extremely similar to that of Spencer's, as he attended the same school, Maidwell Hall. I started by asking if they remembered the day they found out that they would be leaving home and how that felt.
I don't remember the actual day of being told that I was going to this or any such institution, but I can certainly remember the day that I arrived there.
Andrew started at Maidwell Hall in the autumn of 1959.
I can remember looking through the... Maidwell Hall is a country house of a certain sort, and it had a lobby, which we weren't normally allowed to use because boys weren't allowed to use the front door of the house. We had to sort of scurry around the back or around the sides. But I can remember looking back through the one of the two glass doors that encased the little lobby in the small hall area, and seeing my mother in floods of tears, and being comforted by my father as they turned away from me, and thinking that in some sense, and this was the beginning of a pattern of behaviour that has tremendous ramifications, I think, thinking that I had to kind of not be that visibly upset myself in order to spare her from being upset. I suppose my father was upset too, but he wasn't going to show it in a sort of stoic way. But my mum was simply not able to contain her own unhappiness about this. But there was a weird twist in my version of the story, because the headmaster of Maidwell Hall, when I arrived there, was a man called Oliver Wyatt, who, as I mentioned in my piece for you, was a friend of my grandfather's, of my father's father. In fact, Oliver Wyatt's ancient sister was a sort of girlfriend of my grandfather, as far as I can work out from this point in time. So there was an odd sort of shadow of home in what was profoundly not home. by this association between him and my father's family. And I can remember looking at Oliver Wyatt, whom we boys called Beak, expecting him to be like a family friend, but of course he never was, at least not during the term times. Anyway, occasionally I bumped into him in the holidays, which was almost literally nauseating, because whenever I looked at him, he had a kind of penumbra of horror around him because of the associations that I had with him as a schoolmaster.
Richard differentiated his experience from Andrew's primarily because he wasn't sent across the country hundreds of miles from the place he knew as home. Rather, his parents' house was just 6 miles down the road.
And there was always a sense for me of half being in it and half not being in it, which I think allowed me to keep a bit more perspective, perhaps, than those boys. It was an all-boys school when I started, who had effectively been abandoned there. I mean, the parents who live abroad was fairly common, or at the other end of the country, and they really didn't have any contact with their family at all. And this, as Andrew is saying, had an impact on the way that they felt, because they felt very sad and were told they weren't really allowed to feel that, and therefore doubted their own emotions. And they also wanted to go home, and they were told they weren't really allowed to want that. So then they doubted their own desires as well. So you have these two key things, which right from the beginning become untrustworthy. You know, what you feel and what you want. And when you take that away from anybody, not just children, it becomes very difficult to locate yourself in life.
As I've already mentioned, Charles Spencer's book details the horror and abuse he encountered at boarding school. I wanted to know how Richard and Andrew encountered the culture at their schools, particularly the ideas of silence and punishment.
I think Maidwell Hall was staffed by a particular cast of grotesques, really. And other schools would have had the same kind of sort of punishment routines, the same kind of disciplines, but in a slightly diluted form. I mean, it does seem to be very intense, the experience there with a kind of collective of disturbed teachers, in fact, disturbed staff, going right through to the matrons. But I do think that the kind of rituals and the routine in schools in the 70s and 80s and boarding schools were modelled on schools going back through the century. So they had much more to do with what happened at the beginning of the century than at the end. And say George Orwell's experiences at his school in the 1910s, which he recounts in the 1940s in Such Were the Joys, his essay, were recognizable to anybody in a boarding school in the 1970s, right down to the vocabulary. And so this is a very strict upbringing where transgression will be punished, where nobody is expected to question the reasons why. And really, the idea is to break down the child and then to remold the child in a form where, going back to the roots of these schools, where you'll be ready to serve the empire. We'll go into the public schools, who will then finesse this early education. But you'll be a good servant of empire. We have no questioning of authority, no question of British greatness. I mean, there is a kind of jingoistic element to the education, but if you do, you will be punished. And so you have abuse on the one side, and you have this very partial education on the other. And of course, there's a social aspect to it, whereby you are better than other people who have not got this education. I mean, if you're continually told this is the best education money can buy, you know, by implication, everybody else who's not in a private school is not getting the best education, and ultimately will be less clever than you, and less moral than you, and less able than you, and less qualified to be prime minister. So I think the knock-on effects go all the way through.
Earlier in our conversation, Andrew mentioned his former headmaster, a man the pupils nicknamed Beak. This was one of two headmasters who oversaw his time at Maidwell Hall. In his essay for The New Statesman, Andrew wrote that the influence of these men had, in several respects, blighted the whole course of my adult life, and several times threatened to capsize it altogether. I mean, that's devastating. What can you talk us through that?
Well, yes. I mean, perhaps the first thing to say, and this picks up from your previous question to me. As a child of seven, I simply didn't have the compass to understand quite what was happening to me. I mean, like most children, for good and for ill, they simply sort of accept or don't accept what's happening to them as an existential fact. I mean, because you don't have any agency, or very limited agency, as a child. So the ways in which we're all talking about this experience now are profoundly unlike the ways in which I was actually experiencing it. And in some sense, it was simply happening to me. So such wisdom as I've been able to kind of gather about it, such insight as I've been able to apply to it in later life, did indeed come very much, much later. And I think that's an important sort of caveat to put over this, because it contributes, among other things, to our sense of the child as this completely isolated and put upon figure who doesn't even have the wherewithal to understand the experience that they're being put through. But with that caveat, and in hindsight, I've absolutely no doubt in my mind at all that original experience of being, to use the word that Richard was using, abandoned in this school, that sense of abandonment and the fearfulness that went with it, have helped develop in my later life all kinds of aspects of myself that I wish weren't there at all. For instance, it cultivated in me and in many of people who had similar sorts of experience a rather egregious wish to be liked, because to be liked was simply a way to avoid being punished. And that, among other things, has made me, I think, rather reluctant to be at all confrontational. I've spent a long part of my adult life trying to moderate that, because clearly there are some times in life when you need to confront the things that are disagreeable to you or offensive or simply wrong. But I've always found that rather a difficult thing to be and to do. And I have to say, I noticed that very much in my father as well, who had a very similar experience to my own, which speaks to Richard's point about how this is a kind of multi-generational problem that we're talking about here. So there's that. And with it, a general temptation to be avoidant in my behavior, to avoid making firm decisions about things because I was likely to get into trouble if I did so. And with it, I must say, despite the absolutely right point that Richard's making about how these schools have produced all kinds of people in positions of power through the generations, it also produced in me an absolutely numbing effect on my intellect. I mean, I learned almost nothing at this school because I was in such a state of sort of temerity of one kind or another, that my mind was really frozen over by the time that I left. I was quite a stupid boy, not I would like to think because I'm sort of innately stupid, but because my mind was simply not able to deal with the requirements of learning, because its whole effort was being persuaded to cope with the kind of daily other sorts of things that I had to deal with in order to stay out of trouble, to not be punished, to keep on the right side of things, you know. And even though quite a lot of, I mean, as we all agree, in fact, an alarming number of people in position of power still had this sort of experience, I very often notice that, or have persuaded myself anyway, that the kind of deviousness that you find in a lot of people in positions of authority, I think stems from this encouragement to be avoidant in early days. Political deviousness especially, I think, is interestingly connected to this.
I mean, I think there are lots of strategies which are developed to then hide yourself. I mean, and this goes right back to those first days of homesickness where your true self wants to go and cry in the corner, and you hide that, and you learn as a protective strategy not to show who you really are. And Andrew's saying that avoiding confrontation is one way to do that. Being charming is another way to do that, because you put out an impression of yourself, which means that you don't have to show who you really are. Another way is going the opposite direction to Andrew, and actually trying very hard in a competitive sense to do well at school, because the approval you can get for that, on the one hand, it stops you being punished, but it also is a substitute for love. Nobody is in that school to love you, but you want this approval to stand in for that. And if you do very well in your lessons, you will get that approval. And then that competitive urge, if I do well in school, if I do well in my job, then eventually the drive there is about the absence of love rather than loving a job or wanting to do good. And again, that can kind of slightly skew attitudes in later life. In fact, can skew them intensely, not slightly. But there are all these different strategies can come into play in different proportions in different people. But I think it's all about hiding that terrified small child. In fact, their strategies, which are, you know, the most important thing to you and to your sense of self is to actually hide that true and inner self, which is suffering, you know, at that early age, and all those strategies are part of that.
One of the most disturbing things is how sadistic these two headmasters seem to be. Andrew wrote that they had a taste for brutality. Why were they more interested in beating the boys than educating them?
Because for them to put themselves in that situation meant that they had a kind of absolutely ample supply of people to be abusive towards. I mean, the only mitigating thing that I've been able to come up with when I think about what on earth they thought they were doing, and leaving aside from them the question of, though it is a very big question, I think, of how extraordinarily unregulated all this was. I mean, what the hell were the governors doing, let alone the parents? I never saw a governor at the school. I suppose they came to see what was going on, but they didn't do any interfering that I'm aware of. But the only mitigating circumstance that I can, or the only mitigating fact that I can, that is perhaps worth putting in here, is that I think almost all of the people who taught me had, like my father, been through the war. And one of the things that, again, hindsight allows one to say, perhaps, is that they were acting out their own traumas that had been inflicted on them, both no doubt by their own schooling in turn, but also by whatever it was that they'd been through in the war. Can I, while we're saying this, just add one thing that I meant to say earlier, which is that it took me a very long time to be able to talk critically of what happened to me, because it always struck me, and I think I'm not alone in feeling this, that that really I was complaining about having had what everybody else thought was a silver spoon put in my mouth. In other words, this was meant to be a privileged upbringing, and it was described as that, and paid for as such a thing, which has a kind of gagging effect, because nobody wants to hear somebody moaning about being privileged. You know, I mean, that's a ridiculous thing. And I feel that that was an important part of the way in which these outrageous institutions, and apparently mine especially, or in particular, were able to get away with it.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
In his piece for The New Statesman, Richard wrote about the emotional damage instilled by the boarding school experience. The symptoms, he says, instilled from an early age include emotional detachment, dissociation, cynicism, exceptionalism, defensive arrogance, offensive arrogance, cliquism, compartmentalisation, guilt, grief, denial, strategic emotional misdirection, and stiff-lipped stoicism. Or, translated into non-therapeutic English, thanks, I'm fine. And I just wonder, you're talking about the staff who've been through this same experience. Do you think the behaviour is the product of the institution, or do you think that the fact that these people then go on to positions of authority, it's what's allowed the boarding system to operate in that way for such a long time, or both? I mean,
well, the pathway was very clear going from the prep school, and you described in your introduction that the prep school is there to prepare the children for the public schools, then through the public schools, then if all goes well, you go into Oxbridge, then from Oxbridge into the civil service or into eventually into government or into banks, into the military, into the church, into the judiciary. You can see all these different sort of pathways which are there, but the pathway is absolutely clear. Now, and if you keep on getting the rewards, you know, why is anyone going to change the way that you're going back down the ladder? You know, any point, well, if I'm still getting the reward at the end of it and I can see how people have gone through the system, why would you change any part of it while, you know, British society still rewards this way of educating children? And you know, that was true in this era when boarding schools could be incredibly abusive, like Andrew's school, Charles Spencer's school, or simply very old-fashioned, which I think was more the case for my school. But it's still the case now with the private education system. Or why change it if by paying a lot of money and going into these very you know, exclusive schools, you end up where you wanted to go all the way along, all the way through, which was, you know, in the elite of the country. So I think that's the answer to the question. The two things are connected. If society as a whole decided, actually, we're not going to reward this kind of behavior, then you would think about, well, there must be a different way of creating different behaviors in children, more open, more generous, less fearful. But in fact, there's no need to do that, because you go through the system, you will end up as a judge, you know, or a member of parliament. So no, I think the two things are connected, really, is that the pathway is so clear that it does mitigate against change.
And what impact does that have in the long term on the country?
Well, look around, see what it looks like right now, and see whether this looks like a country in good health, good psychological health. You know, a kind of psychological assessment of Britain at the moment, certainly since 2016, say, to take a date off the top of my head, I would say that it's not very healthy. And we need to start looking at the reasons why. Now, there's this legacy and hangover from people who are now in positions of power who were educated in the 70s and 80s. But then there are younger people who went through the same system who seem to have some of the same issues to address. But it would be a major job to basically apply therapy to Britain, and it would be a very useful thing to do.
But just to push back a little bit on the thesis, I mean, given that we do have, you know, a younger cohort of politicians, of judges, of lawyers, or what have you, who haven't had those same experiences, does it stand up?
I mean, I think it does stand up, because the isolation of these schools allowed the kind of, you know, horrific experience that Andrew had, that Charles Spencer had. The isolation is still there. I don't think the same kind of horrific stories are being experienced in these schools, but the isolation is there, the exclusivity is there, and it's in that isolation and exclusivity that strange ideas can breed, even if they're not around corporal punishment or around sexual perversions. And these strange ideas, you know, they could be economic, they could be social, but to be so excluded from the rest of the country means then there is a lack of empathy for the rest of the country when you come out of this system. And that's as true today as it was in Maidwell Hall back in Andrew's day.
Andrew?
Well, I feel slightly hesitant to answer this with any sense of authority, because I haven't lived in England for the last 10 years. And one of the reasons I was so glad to get out of it is precisely to do with all the things that we're talking about. But when I do look back across the Atlantic, and I'm speaking to you now from Baltimore, where I live and work, I see a government which seems to be entirely staffed by people who bear a very close resemblance to the people who were prefects at the sorts of schools that I went to. And indeed, did themselves, apparently, in a large number of cases, come from those sorts of schools, including, of course, the Prime Minister himself. And even though they might not have been through the mill in quite the same sorts of way that people of my age and generation did, it seems highly likely to me, in fact, certain, that the patterns of expectation that those schools bred in them are the ones that they're now acting out in society at large. So all kinds of acceptances of inequalities and injustices and imbalances and so on are predicated on that original template, I think.
It's interesting, though, because some of the qualities or some of the impact you've described of being in that environment, you'd think would be the opposite of creating a good leader. You know, you talked about compliance, breaking someone down, someone that doesn't question, that's, you know, anti-confrontation. You'd think actually that would make a terrible leader.
You would, wouldn't you? But weirdly, and again, perhaps I don't know as much as I would do if I lived in the UK in answering in this, but those very qualities, and actually particularly in the Prime Minister, seem to be present in addition to or mingled in with the sort of assertions that a person in that position has to make.
You go on any of the websites of these schools now, that's today, not back in Andrew's day, Maidwell Hall, but at any of the websites, they will cite leadership as one of the things that they will teach the children whose parents pay for and education. So there's an expectation of leadership, even if there isn't a matching set of skills which is given through the education.
And that's really interesting. I'm keen not to conflate private schools necessarily with boarding schools. I mean, do you think there's something unique about the boarding experience? You know, it's your home. While 93% of the UK population attend state schools and only 7% attend private schools, less than 0.7% of the school attending population in the UK are boarders. This number includes the almost 30,000 overseas students who attend British boarding schools. You know, it's your home, isn't it, as well as your education, that doesn't apply to private schools? Or are you equally concerned? Do you think there's enough similarities there? Because obviously more people went to private schools, but it's still disproportionate.
As far as I'm aware, again, that is a distinction which is very well worth making, I must say. I mean, I don't know about what private schools are sort of generally like in the UK anymore, but certainly the experience of being uprooted from home and transplanted in the way that both Richard and I were was profoundly formative of character and our expectations of life.
Would Richard apply the same arguments that he and Andrew have made about those who are boarding school educated also to those who are privately educated?
Yes, I would apply some of them, because I think the exclusivity, the social exclusivity, the kind of social distinctions which are made within the school between those who are there at the school and who are lucky and who are privileged, as Andrew has said, it is just drummed into those children that they are lucky to be in that private school. And there are reasons for that. But this reinforces the divisions between people who go to private schools and those who don't. Now, boarding school is an extreme version of that. And if you're in a private day school and you have the advantage of going home to see your parents every day, you obviously have love in your life in a way that you don't if you're at boarding school. You also hopefully have a bit of common sense from your parents to counter some of these sort of wild claims which are made by private schools about what they can achieve for children as well.
Here, Richard wanted to loop back to Andrew's idea about the privilege of attending one of these schools.
What's interesting in Charles Spencer's case is that there's an idea that he sent to that school because his family have always done this. They've been private schools since, I think he says in his book, 1716. You know, he has an ancestry, goes to Eton. So really going to a private school for his class of person is very much about avoiding downward social mobility. It's just making sure you don't go downwards. But most people, it seems, are interested in private school because of upward social mobility. And again, if your parents are very interested in that, in the sense of making sacrifices to pay for you to go to the school, it becomes very hard to resist the propaganda of the school. So when you say, well, do you think it's good for some people? And Andrew says, you know, he knows people who says it was wonderful. I mean, part of the internal propaganda is these are the best days of your lives. And once that's sort of inside you, and they're going back to boarding school, people have gone to boarding schools, the same school as Andrew. And I think in the New Statesman, the edition of the New Statesman after his review, where he said, yes, Charles Spencer said it was terrible. I was there. It was terrible. There was a letter which said I was there at the same time and it wasn't terrible. And I loved it. Best days of my life. Frankly, I'm quite skeptical about that. I think that's someone who has really not wanted to question what happened, you know, at that school and the after effects of those experiences. And it is part of the education not to be too introspective, which is why it's interesting Andrew should go off and then write poems, which requires constant introspection. It's an act of resistance in itself to do that.
But I think it's easier to be skeptical about that, given the brutality and sadism of the regime that both Andrew and Charles Spencer described, than being skeptical about someone who goes to a private day school having a good education and enjoying it. I mean, that just seems utterly believable.
Yeah, but it does show that you can have the most extreme experience and still say it was wonderful. So if you listen to private school children now who seem to have had a very nice experience and they say it was all wonderful, well, it's even easier to say. I mean, there's no kind of questioning there at all. So I don't think the skepticism about the education is part of the education, and that's one of the problems of the education.
I want to ask you about sort of moving forward, because if Labour are elected in the next election, whenever that might be, we're going to see a cabinet that will be Britain's most state educated since 1945. So we've got 13% privately educated compared to 59% of the Conservative cabinet, bearing in mind that only 7% of the population is privately educated. I'm just wondering if that gives you any hope for you know, if that gives you any cause for hope or optimism. I mean, how do you think we'll see a tangible difference in style of government?
I bloody well hope so. And yes, I do feel optimistic about it. I mean, even at this distance.
Yes, I think it's going to be interesting to see what actually happens in terms of the plans to add VAT to the school fees and the other financial penalties which could be imposed on private schools, because private schools do have a long history of resisting change. And of course, their lobbying groups, the people who are prepared to lobby for them, are incredibly powerful. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how much that gets watered down. I would suspect it's going to be a lot more difficult than it feels in opposition to actually make these changes, because there is this history which goes right back to the middle of the 19th century where private schools can resist anybody who comes onto their territory, and they're quite ruthless in doing so. So I would expect them to put up a really big fight. It'll be interesting to see how that goes.
So you think it's going to be doubtful that they'll push through with that 20% VAT?
Well, I think there will be a lot of obstacles which are put in their way, and it's up. Then it will be interesting to see how determined they are to do that when they see the interest groups in positions of power, you know, in the judiciary, in the media, in particular. It's going to be really a test of their principles, I think.
But that's interesting. You say here's hoping. What do you think would be the impact if it were to go through of that VAT increase?
Well, I think it would have a big impact, because it'd be a start. This is a way of starting to say, well, if this is a commodity that you're buying and you put VAT on it in the same way as you do on other commodities which are bought, that this kind of special status which are given to private schools starts to erode. And by doing that, then you can start to erode the special status that they have in relation to, say, Oxford and Cambridge, which has been happening from the university's point of view, but not from the private school's point of view. They would wish it hadn't happened. And the more you chip away at it, then eventually that will be a way of stopping it having such power in the country, stopping private education having access to these pathways.
Are you saying that it chips away? Well, I was just wondering, is the argument that it chips away at the special status because fewer people will be able to afford it? Is that the argument?
Well, that is part of the argument. I think what I would want to say is that I think doing it gradually like this is a much better bet. It's more likely to have a long-lasting effect than if you try and say, as the Labour Party did in the 1980s, we are just going to abolish private education. I think that was never going to be something which could happen. And I think this idea of doing it in increments is the best way to go about it. But if you increase the price and it means that the middle classes who are aspirational find it difficult to go in, and you've kind of reserving this education for the children of, you know, oligarchs and hedge fund managers, then it becomes suddenly much less attractive, which then forces this very active sector of society to get involved in their state schools and to be invested in their own communities, which at the moment doesn't happen as much as it should. I mean, it does happen, thankfully, in some places, but it can happen more.
How do you respond to the argument, though, that you're kind of levelling down? You're not bringing state schools up. You're forcing, as you say, like the middle classes to, I mean...
But actually, aren't you raising state schools as a consequence of making the private schools so expensive that fewer people are going there, and in the process allowing the voices that are heard presumably within the private school system lobbying for the quality of education that they do lobby for, moving those voices over into the state system and getting them to do their lobbying there?
Yeah, arguably.
But we also have then... you know, hopefully people who are in positions of power making decisions about education will have some knowledge of the British state school education system, which is not necessarily the case at the moment. I can't see that there are a lot of, you know, disadvantages to this new dispensation.
I mean, other than the proposed policy of putting 20% VAT on private school fees, do you sense, though, that we'll have a different feel of government because a smaller proportion have gone through this private school system that we've been talking about? Do you think that will have a difference on the style of government as opposed to just that one policy?
Well, again, I mean, that seems to me a perfectly reasonable thing to hope for, if only that more people will be able to recognise themselves in the people who are in positions of power that affect their lives, in the sense that they'll be able to identify more easily with the experiences that got them there in the first place.
We were coming to the end of our conversation, and although we'd already touched on it, I wanted to revisit the idea that boarding schools had evolved since the 1970s and 80s. we no longer have corporal punishment. And today, when someone shares their account of surviving a boarding school, that school is often very quick to issue a statement emphasising the fact that things have changed.
I mean, first of all, is that a fair point, that things have changed?
I suppose so, yes. I mean, I did once, before I left England, go back to Maidwell as an adult to talk to the boys about poems, in fact, and was almost suffocated by protestations that things had changed. I could see that they had changed in the sense that people weren't queuing up every night to be beaten and so on and so forth. But I was very struck at the same time by how the kind of social disposition of the school seemed to me exactly the same. And no doubt the sort of expectations about what would happen to these kids in later life was exactly the same. There was exactly the same sense of entitlement in the making there.
Because culturally, you know, there's this pressure, isn't there, to progress in step with these broader societal changes. I mean, we have Eton's headmaster who describes himself as woke, for example. And, I mean, is it possible to have elitism, if you like, coexisting with progress?
Well, I mean, I think, that is a question. What does this mean? You can, you know, within the schools, you can have diversity of some kinds and not others. And the one type of diversity you're not going to have is financial diversity. I mean, the issue of bursaries is slightly different, but there's something hugely patronizing in the idea that you can pick out, you know, some like a fairy godmother, you know, pick out some urchins and put them into Eton or any other big public school and suddenly make them into wonderful human beings, you know, with a wave of the wand. And it doesn't change any of the social divisions which have led to perhaps the disadvantage of the child you're picking out in the first place. So that's one way in which they would say they're woke, through the bursaries. I think here it's quite interesting to think about the customer, about the parents who are paying, presumably because these are, you know, commercial entities, they need to sell the places in their schools, that the wokeness is something that parents like. If the parents don't like it, then perhaps the teachers are being incredibly brave. Do they like it? I don't know, right? I don't know how that's going. I think this is really quite a recent development. Are there going to be lots of rich parents who say, no, I don't want, this isn't what I'm paying for? No. I don't think any parents now would say, I'm paying for beatings and unheated swimming pools that you jump into, you know, in April. But they are very, very clearly now customers and paying for something. It'll be interesting to see whether that changes, you know, the view of the consumer in that sense. I don't know the answer to that. I think that's something which is still being played out, really.
Does the very fact, though, that you know, you've described the parents are customers, does the very fact that you're paying for this education, does that prevent these elite private schools from undergoing like proper meaningful reform, do you think? I mean, what would reform look like, or is it not possible?
It depends where the parents are putting the emphasis, doesn't it? I mean, if I were such a parent, my priority would be for my child to be properly educated in the sense of that it was to do with learning and being brilliantly taught by people who knew what they were talking about and did it in a way that connected the things that they were teaching to the life that these kids were going to lead once they'd left the place. And if that emphasis were placed properly, then I can easily imagine that a lot of parents would want to send their children to such an institution. But the idea of, to go back to your original question, the idea of trying to reconcile wokeness with an elite institution such as Eton is such a kind of paradoxical notion that it's very hard to imagine it working out in reality. Because it's Eton, for God's sake. I mean, how woke can it be? I mean, if the headmaster of Eton considers himself to be woke, what does he mean by that? I mean, if he means to be properly enlightened about these things, then he might be asking what on earth he's doing working for such an institution in the first place.
But I think that connects to the idea of what is a good education. And now, if a good education for me would include learning about, you know, the utter injustice of having more sports facilities than most small towns for 1,000 privileged boys. And if you don't come out horrified by that and wanting to change everything, then you haven't been educated properly. And there's a kind of a paradox there. It's not going to happen. And therefore, it means the education can't be that good, because otherwise you would notice this and want to do something about it. And that doesn't seem to be what happens to the majority of people who come out of the schools. So can it change? It can't really change unless you face these kind of injustices, but facing these injustices threatens the existence of the schools in the first place. So I think it's unlikely to happen.
What a place to leave it. Thank you so much to both of you. Really appreciate your time and sharing your experiences. It's been fascinating. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to submit a question for us to discuss on a future podcast, you can do so at newstatesman.com/youaskus. If you're listening on Spotify, just scroll down on the episode page and type your reply. Or if you're watching on YouTube, you can leave a question in the comments. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Hannah Barnes, and my guests, Andrew Motion and Richard Beard. We'll be back on Thursday with the latest from This Week in Politics. This episode was produced by Catherine Hughes.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.